When the world ended, you lost everything. You survived because you had each other. Now, one of you has been infected. In your final days together, what will you say? Hey, it's Elliot from the My First Dungeon team, and I'm excited to tell you about my next game, The Time We Have, A Conversation Between Brothers, a tragic zombie storytelling game headed to BackerKit on October 29th. This game is played on opposite sides of a closed door with a custom deck of cards that will guide you through a story about what it means to be a brother in the final days before one of you turns. To make this game a reality, we need your help to give us the best possible launch on day one. So please head to bit.ly/thetimewehave and pre-save the campaign so you can be notified as soon as we launch. That's bit.ly/thetimewehave.
Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
This week, we're sitting down with Will Yobst. They are a designer, editor, and publisher, one half of Good Luck Press, known for such games as Torque, This Discord Has Ghosts in It, and the upcoming Big Grave Fashion Fantasy and Plasmodics. They are a prolific, prolific TTRPG editor. Just go ahead and grab a book off your shelf, check the name next to editor. There's a decent chance that name is Will Yobst. Will, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Hey, Brian and Elliot, thank you so much. It is great to be here. I'm excited to talk about all the books that you're now pulling off your shelf. It's going to be great.
Everybody's ripping books off their shelves at home right now. It's a mess.
Hopefully you nailed that shelf to the damn wall.
Yes.
Are you shelf nailers?
I'm a shelf nailer.
Do you do this yet?
Oh, no, I don't. I always look at it and I think, you should do that. It'll take you 10 minutes. Just go do it. And I never do.
Yeah. Or you'll die.
Yeah.
You know, you'll die
exactly.
In kind of a fun Victorian way, just crushed by books.
Kind of how I want to go, I think.
Yeah, definitely not a bad way to go.
Yeah.
Aged librarian style death you could go for.
So, Will, what we always like to do at the top of these conversations is sort of lay out what our goal for the conversation is, what we'd like to dig into. So our goal for this is to kind of dig into the mind of Will Yobst a little bit. We want to talk about you as an editor, a designer, and overall as somebody with a really strong perspective and what I would call an expertise in the TTRPG space. So I would love to start with a little bit of a exercise. In one sentence, could you describe your TTRPG ethos at large?
Yeah, easy. That's so good. Let me just rip it right now. Go ahead. I was sent a list of questions in the beginning.
Yeah, I deliberately did not prepare you for this one.
What a bastard. Let's see. I think something I think about very often is you said expertise earlier. I don't think there are any master game designers. And I think that's like the one thing. And that's a very kind of democratizing playing field evening idea that I keep in my head a lot, is that there are no masters.
Mm.
Simply not an art form old enough to have masters in it. Just going to say it. And that idea is really powerful and really exciting. And because it is a little bit of a folk art, a little bit of, as indie designers, I think, Ellie, you definitely know this, that we do absolutely everything. And so your own, this is turning into a 45 sentence answer, but that you can learn how to do anything. And then games is a very cool art form, a gestalt art form that you can pull together your interests in a complete thought that is a game. Next question.
I guess we'll distill that down to there are no masters in game design.
I would say there are masters. You're going to get a lot of dungeon masters really.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Absolutely fucked.
Your
email. I would hate to be your mailer daemon right now. No, there are no master game designers.
I do really like that idea. It does, as you said, it does feel very democratizing that like this is something that is still open to everyone, is still accessible to everyone. You just got to put in the effort, the work to learn how to do all the things, because you will indeed have to learn how to do all the things.
Yeah, or maybe Well, as we'll discuss later, maybe not. Maybe you can hire other people to help you. But,
yeah, very true, very true.
Or collaborate or whatever it is. Yeah. And I think that, like, there are no master game designers means that, like, game is such a elemental human aspect of playing, just play in general, not to get all anthropological about it, but...
No, we love it.
No, go there.
Like, your, you know, 4X board game designers are as much masters of design as Discord mods and an RP server. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Mm.
Going from there and just pivoting a little bit to kind of get two sides of the coin that is Will Yobst, I think general an audience, a listener, would understand what an editor does. An editor of a TTRPG is a little bit more nebulous, and I think it was definitely a lot more specific. Can you give us like a brief introduction of what you do as an editor, as a TTRPG editor, that is different from what a novel editor would do?
I've done both, so I can totally. Lot less goblins in a contemporary lit fic novel,
and all the worse depending. For it.
Yeah. Wow, they could really use some goblins, couldn't they?
Hell yeah.
Like, imagine all those book covers. I'll get to the very thoughtful question in a second, but imagine all those book covers that are like a field of leaves and like some letters poking out, and there should be a goblin eyes somewhere on there. Slap a goblin on it. Yeah, so I have this conversation a lot when I am talking to new clients, people that have not been edited before, by anything about kind of what the job is. And there are three types of editing broadly. And it is very trackable to the page. By that, I mean, there are word level editors, which are proofreaders. They make sure all the words are spelled right, that they go in an order that makes some sense. There are copy editors that make sure the sentences work right, either mechanically, stylistically, whatever it is. And there are development editors, which make sure the paragraphs go in the right order or as are where they appear. So developmental editing is taking a bird's eye view, looking at everything, the book, its construction, the ideas, the author's goals, and make sure they're executed and engages in a different conversation than a copy editor would have with an editor or with an author or than a proofreader would have with an author. So as a tabletop game editor, I do all three, and it depends, it highly depends on the manuscript, where it is, how it's looking, and what the author actually needs from me. But that development edit might be a mechanics edit. The mechanics might go within the copy editing purview, but when you're drawing the battle lines like that, it gets a little hairy about what's happening when and where experience really kicks in for what needs to get done.
So that's a great overview of TTRPG editing broadly, these three steps. And because you're hitting all three of those steps, we wanted to give you what I hope is a fun and I hope valuable opportunity for our listeners to speak to new designers, veteran designers, and warn them about all the bad habits that you see given all of the TTRPG editing you've done. What are those things that you see over and over again that you kind of wish people might fix before it ever even comes your way?
Yeah, I thought a lot about this question, and being one of my clients yourself, things I wish Elliot would have done
yes.
when editing.
Yes, pick apart project
Elliot specifically.
What would I have? No, you know my style. I edit in a conversational constructive style where I am holding a dialogue with you as the designer, the royal you now to the listener, but like literally to Elliot, about what I am experiencing, where my train of thought is as I'm working through the manuscript, what I'm seeing, what I'm not seeing, things like that to try and build a more cohesive end goal. And I like to say that I can only increase the letter grade of a manuscript by one letter. That's like the most editing can do. That could be a transformative edit, or it could be like just more polish on a diamond. But if there's one thing that people listening to this that are making games, that are soliciting editors, that kind of stuff, something you could do is make a style guide, which is it could be just a text document. It could be a notebook page where you just write how your words are supposed to look, what words are important to your game, and how they should always appear. And it helps solve a lot of problems before they come up because you have this like linguistic conception of your game at that point. And that is a super easy thing to do, even if it's just like, oh yeah, my game, Project Echo, it's always capitalized no matter where you see it, for example.
It is really helpful. Like as the layout artist for Project Echo, it was really helpful after seeing your notes, being able to go back in and like you slowly make those adjustments. And when you're looking at the layout, you see it just becomes so obvious when something isn't correct and when something isn't following a style guide, because we sat down and we were like, okay, it's always this, this, this. We always capitalize here. We always italicize here. So then all of a sudden, what seems like a pretty small thing, by the time you're actually like getting through the manuscript and through the book, it really does add up to feel much more like cohesive and clear and concise for the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that is will save you hours down the line where you're just going through your final InDesign file, control F searching for Goblin to make sure it's spelled with like an E like the way you want. And it happens all the time. I'm sure everyone who has released even a zine, even just done some writing themselves, have found that that's a sticky wicket. And having a source of truth like that just by your side with the process that's alive and you can adjust it, it's great.
Are there any other like bad habits that you would suggest people nip in the bud, or is it all
plagiarizing?
Plagiarizing, I mean, is a bad
other
habit.
other than crimes.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'm gonna take a much less punitive standpoint with that and say that like if you are down to collaborate with an editor, that's awesome. You're working together. You're gonna make something great, and that's exciting. And for everything else, you know, just read some cool books and then you learn how to write. That's like the best way to learn how to write, just reading good stuff.
Totally. And I do love that you are framing the relationship as a collaboration, because that is what I remember about the experience of working with you on Echo, was that it was a conversation. It was a collaboration. Like even when I was just, you know, looking through the marked up manuscript, everything that you delivered was not in a, like you said, punitive way. It was a question. It was like, how can we make this more interesting? How can we make this more clear? You know,
I'm remembering looking through the legally required release of Milo Yiannopoulos's book. You know this guy?
Yeah, I've heard of him.
you've heard of. I don't know if you have read. Because released in Discovery were the comments that his editors left in his book.
Mm.
And you could tell they just fucking hated this so much. They are so funny. So there's definitely a world, especially in the prestige publishing world, where editors are given like absolute fiat over manuscripts, and you hear lots of sad stories about manuscripts looking really different after editing in a way that the authors might not love. And because I serve at the pleasure of the president, aka the authors are hiring me themselves, I just get to work with someone who's invested in making their thing as good as it can be.
Totally. And I remember it was one of those things where, like, for first-time designers, maybe first-time collaborators with an editor, like, it was one of those things I was nervous about going into, like, sharing a manuscript with someone with the ask of, like, kind of show me what I'm doing wrong, what I'm doing right, how I can make this better. But I remember as soon as I got it back from you, it was way easier than I expected. It was a much more comfortable process than, like, what I had built it up to have something go through an edit pass, so...
Yeah, school really fucks you up for that.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, school absolutely fucks you up. English teachers can be great and they can be terrible. It's so non-helpful. So, yeah. And it's different for projects with like a single author or projects with a dozen authors, because you have to calibrate to different things and figure out who's looking at the manuscript when. Oh, I thought of another thing that people could never do.
Oh, go for it.
Don't use Google Docs. Google Docs, massive L, I'm going to actually stick it right to the Alphabet Corporation and say, I don't think they're very good.
Damn. As a Google Docs user, I'm a little shaken.
It's horrible. Has your blood ever run colder than getting a notification that someone's editing your doc and did something you don't like? Would you say that that's a good feeling?
What workflow do you prefer?
So I often write, I sometimes write with a collaborator, but I often, when I'm designing my own games, work in Scrivener, and then I work in Google Docs. No, then I work in Microsoft Word, like they used to do back in ancient
Microsoft
times.
Word's not exactly, you know, belle of the ball when it comes to softwares.
Yes, it is. Excuse me.
Excuse me.
No, Google Docs sucks complete shit. I'm just going to say it. Have you ever tried to, like, export something that a layout artist would ever want to touch with Google Docs?
Only Brian. So
Brian.
It was my first time doing a layout, so I don't have a good comparison.
Could be harder. Could it? Google Docs will, like, strip your formatting and start changing stuff. And
that is true. I had
slurs
on
your manuscripts. It's, like, really messed up.
That is true. That is very true.
Yeah, there were a few pages I had to rebuild.
See?
Yeah.
That's precious Brian hours.
We only get so many of those.
Yeah. Brian could be playing Baldur's Gate right now.
I'm resisting the urge to go after Microsoft Word, but that's not why we're here.
No, I mean go for it. I've spent, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell amount of time with it. But my workflow with an editor is Google Docs, or fucking Google Docs, is Microsoft Word.
Now we just don't believe you. Now I think it's unclear. A lie.
Yeah. One of them always lies. Yeah. So Microsoft Word, and when working with an editor, there's no better app to edit with that people use and everyone has on their computers or can easily access. The level of detail you can get with, like, redlining and moving stuff around and just, you know, manuscript clarity, it's great. I mean, it's the reason why it's called Microsoft Word, right? Because it's great.
That's the reason it's called Microsoft Word. That's
why. I would rather tell you about why Google Docs is bad. I think manuscript collaboration is awesome, and I think that great art is made that way. But literally, two people never need to be touching it at the same time.
Mm.
Life is so long. I mean, we don't got to both be in here knocking shoulders and stuff. I'm sure there are, like, use cases, like, that's how you babysit your terrible sons, as you all get in, like, a Google Doc together. But
that's what I do with my terrible sons. Yeah.
Yeah. You're grounded to Google Docs.
It's funny because we currently have the outline for this conversation open in Google Docs.
So. Yeah, and during a lot of interviews, Elliot and I will actively type into the shared Google Doc of, like, places we think we should go next, or, like, highlight questions that we think should come next.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, just not for a manuscript. I can see the argument that you're making for not being in a manuscript.
You're using Google Docs. Yeah, you're using Google Docs like Slack or something like that.
Yeah. Kind of.
But, like, for when we're talking about book production, it sucks. I mean, like, I often will have to pull it into Microsoft Word to get the level of editorial detail I need. And I hate getting the emails so much. And I'll tell you why. I worked in college on writing a video game. I was the writer. And we used Google Docs for everything. And I was writing on a Chromebook into Google Docs. It couldn't have been better, right? And there was a lot of tension with the script and stuff, and there were lots of changes being made all the time at all weird hours. And I feel like every time I've ever switched Google Docs notifications off, they have found them a way to turn themselves on, like an Android that won't die. And I'll just get them all the time. I could open up my email and show you, like, three right now. And I'm sorry to my clients who I am doxing. But, and dude, it sucks. It's so bad.
Well.
So talking about collaboration and collaborators, I'm wondering, in your work as an editor or in your work as a designer and working with artists and editors of your own, this is a question I've asked a couple people because I like the answers to it. What are the qualities that you've seen consistent in the best collaborators you've worked with?
That's a cool question. I think that my brow's furrowed right now. Let me unfurrow it. Yeah, so I'm thinking of like just cool people. That's kind of the thing. That working with someone that you get along with, this is kind of the thing that Orson Welles talked about, which is like someone accused him of hiring somebody he liked to hang out with. And he was like, of course I hired this person. Why? Why would I hire someone I don't want to work with? I like working with people I get along with that I can easily communicate to, that the communication feels free and like untethered by external pressures, if that makes sense. Like, it's different when it's like editing someone because there's no such thing as those external pressures, because as an editor it must flow like water. But for collaborating on a design, it's really important to find out the things you want to do and the things you don't want to do and the things you care 100% about, and find everything you care 90% about and less, and then just really remember that you don't care about that stuff. So one thing that Adam Vass and I collaborate a lot, our most recent game was Campfire that we worked on together, which was on Kickstarter, a storytelling horror anthology game. But we also do the Brain Trust podcast, among other things. And one thing Adam said to me very early on in our collaboration was that once you bring an idea to me and we start talking about it, or I bring an idea to you and we start talking about it, incorporating it into our project, no one owns that anymore. That's ours. Like, we're both working on it. So really losing that ego about trying to get all these wins and not thinking about the relationship you have to this person, because that's more important than whatever stupid role-playing game you're writing, but also that you can have productive and healthy and beautiful relationship with a collaborator that gives you energy and helps something get done. And if you can at all avoid doing anything but that, you'll live to be 1,000 years old.
I feel like the thing about Orson Welles hiring people that he likes really resonates, because for my day job, I work as an assistant director for film and television. And I always describe film crews as kind of like self-cleaning systems, because, and this is generally true, because you're on set for like 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day. You only want to like work with people who are cool. Like, all things being equal, if two people can do a job and one of them's way funner to work with, those are the people you hire. And anyone who's a bad time, like, slowly gets, very quickly gets washed out. And you slowly just get a cooler and cooler group as shows like come back for season 2, season 3, season 4. There's always outliers to that, of course, but generally, that's how it works.
It's funny that you said that, Will, about like the collaboration. The biggest thing is cool people, because I was recently talking to somebody who said, I guess I don't want to name them. I guess somebody who I did a video call with about a collaboration, and they were saying how I was the first person in a TTRPG collaboration who wanted to get on the phone with them. And I was like, I wouldn't know if I wanted to work with someone if I didn't get on the phone with them. Like, that's a huge step for me. Like, I feel like I have to like get that vibe check, that gut check, you know, from somebody to be sure that I want to, you know, collaborate with them, doing something kind of as vulnerable as collaborating.
Right. And this is not to say that, like, only work with people, you know, and don't expand your network at all to work with people that are not like you or whatever it is. It's that you'll know when it's a good fit. And there's lots of people out there. There's a lot of people doing this thing. And you can find cool people anywhere in the world doing it. But yeah, I mean, this conversation also touches on, like, being cool is great. Being respectful is the best, like having the respect for your collaborator. And that's when something like, you know, even using contracts when working with your friends is like such a good, cool thing to do. Cool people make it very clear what the work is and what the expectations are in a legally binding document. So if you're doing something where there's money involved, I mean, that's, you got to do it, because if you really care about the project and about the people, you will have those conversations.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah, it is. Not only is it like respectful and good and cool to have those very clear boundaries, it also just like takes the pressure off. And like, it sounds like putting up, like drawing up a contract with a friend would be like really stressful. And I'm sure there is a part of it that is. But ultimately, when you establish those very clear lines, it's just like safety tools or session zero in a role-playing game. You have a very clear idea of what you don't want to do and the fun that you do want to have. And now you can have a much better experience doing the thing because you're both exactly on the same page in a very clear, succinct, possibly legally binding way of what type of fun you're going to have.
So what I'm hearing from that is that the X card needs to be legally binding.
Yes. everybody signs the back of the X card at the start.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of fun.
Signing the X card. Jesus. Yeah, and it helps you, like, in the worst possible situations, it gives you a clear path for what happens next. I think there are people probably listening that have had collaborative relationships where there is enough tension and stress that it changes the collaborative relationship and it changes the friendship, period. And that's something you just don't want. No art is worth that. People are so important, and sometimes it'll just happen and you just have to look out in the future for stuff like that. It's happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to y'all. It's weird and it sucks.
But you can hopefully minimize it by taking steps in advance. Like, take the steps when it's easy rather than having to take the steps when it's much harder.
Right. And contracts are things that are alive and can change and can be recreated and can grow as your relationship grows. And so, yeah, it's just a legal way to stay chill with your homie, pretty much.
A legal way to stay chill with your homie.
And then kind of following on the idea of what commonalities do good collaborators have, I was like asking, what commonalities do you see in the most quote-unquote successful games? And successful being however you want to define that.
Wow. You know, I read two D&D books recently. I read, and everyone's holding their breath. What did they read? I read The Ravnica Guide, Guildmaster Guide.
Mm,
sure.
That was a nerd check.
Oh, that's
gotcha.
Yeah.
And
no, I know. Ravnica slaps.
Ravnica's great.
The Waterdeep Dragon Heist Guide.
Sure.
Are you familiar with these?
One of those is a better book, automatically, from my perspective, but I want you to get to it.
Thematically, right?
Yeah.
So in reading these, as a game designer, as a publisher, as a writer, editor, read lots of games, just deconstruct lots of games structurally, what's going on. What in the fuck is going on with the D&D books, everybody? They have fallen so far from grace. So that is to say, quality and success have nothing to do with each other.
For sure.
So,
but I guess how would you define, not defining success in the monetary or the capitalistic way, like in the books that you say, like, this is by my metrics a successful game. Are there any commonalities?
Yeah, I think it would be hard and almost not to be like, I don't agree with this question, but I don't want to atomize the work that I love and find out why I love it the same way I love something else, because I don't know if that's true. And that would take lots of thinking to see if the reason why I love a game like Sledgehammer by John Geary is the same as the reason I love Gamma World First Edition. Like, I think, yeah, it's just such a gulf. But I can say broadly that the games that engage in and establish a strong voice, I like a lot, just as a general aspect. I like games that have a strong self-realized identity for what they are and show the continuity of thought through the game and the experience and the idea and the words and everything. Those are cool. I make those. That's kind of my goal.
Yeah, I was going to say that does sound that what you just said there, like if I had to identify a sort of Will Yobst identity that you can feel in the games you've made, having just read the first bits of Plasmodics, that feels very, very characteristic of what you've done with the beginning of that book. And I love the intro text that you've written there.
Oh, nice.
Thank I guess you. It's not a question. That's just a compliment.
Thank you. Yeah, Plasmodics, weird mutants. Nope. Mutant freaks in the weird future. If you're going to have a subtitle, just you can put it on shuffle. Okay. So if you got a subtitle for your game, feel free to shuffle that playlist of words. But yeah, that is my mutant post-apocalyptic role-playing game. That is a remake of Gamma World, as I just mentioned, that game. It's like one of the first RPGs out of TSR. It's the first post-apocalyptic game. It's amazing for a lot of strange reasons. And I demake the game, which means I put it in the microwave for 90 minutes and then just huffed the whole thing. And then I wrote the manuscript. So
I love that's the official definition from here on out.
Yeah. I put it really nicely in the book, but I don't have it open in front of me.
I do have the quote if you'd like me to read it for the listening audience. Plasmodics is a demake of the first edition of Gamma World, the granddaddy of post-apocalyptic role-playing games. It is successor in spirit only, much like our mutant grandsons sifting through our disintegrated belongings, finding all sorts of funny treasures. If Gamma World was a derelict storage locker, I have entered and choked on the cobwebs, neither retro nor cloned, a demake.
Sick. That slaps.
I like that.
That rocks. Who wrote that?
Slaps. That rocks.
No notes.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom, or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Don't look under the bed. Don't open the closet. And whatever you do, don't skip this ad. World Champ Game Co. is the one-stop shop for all of your horror desires this Halloween season. Sink your teeth into classic thrills with Slasher Card Game 1978, The Night They Came Home. Keep close to the light as you weave eerie new tales with Campfire, anthology horror storytelling. Whatever makes your spine crawl, World Champ has a game for you. Run for your life to worldchamp.io and grab your next favorite horror role-playing game. And right now, get 20% off your order with code KILLER. Again, that's 20% off at worldchamp.io with code KILLER. And when you can't fall asleep at night, just keep telling yourself, it's only a game.
The Between is now crowdfunding on BackerKit. The Between is a new role-playing game from the creators of the award-winning Brindlewood Bay. Inspired by Penny Dreadful and Sherlock Holmes, you play as monster hunters in Victoria-era London, investigating and neutralizing these supernatural threats that terrorize the city. Threats that Scotland Yard can't or won't handle themselves. As the story progresses, you become aware of a criminal mastermind pulling the strings behind the scenes. In the end, you will have to face this mastermind in order to save both Queen and country. Rewards for backing this project include The Between's core rulebook, Shadow Society, an expansion book for the game's London setting, and Sons of Another World, which gives you three brand new settings for The Between. And back early to get access to a limited reward, the glow-in-the-dark Mastermind Dice. So head right now to BackerKit and search the between.
This is something that I feel like you made better about my writing when you edited Project Echo, is you have sort of efficiency plus style down. Like you know when to lay on the style and what to cut to make it all work. That's the thing I found about reading Plasmodics. Like you get people into that game so efficiently and so stylistically in those first few pages. And I guess in that vein, I sort of want to talk about like efficient. No, I don't want to use the word efficient too much because like
I've got a phrase for this.
Yeah, go for it.
I've got a phrase. How do you write highly gameable? How do you insert cubically gameable sentences? The highest cubic gameable sentence, right? It's like this idea that with an economy of words, you can actually do more with less, and often much, much, much more. And how you can, make exquisitely gameable sentences. And when do you find out when you are trying to clearly communicate, and when are you trying to stylistically communicate, and all of this other stuff? Like, when are you, you've got a hot and cold spigot or whatever, like one of those old kind of Northeast U.S. bathrooms. You familiar?
Oh, yeah.
And then you're kind of like
what I have.
Yeah.
Dumping both out into the sink. Can't really get your hands on either of them. You're kind of like a little icy hot situation. If both of those are like the extreme ends of the spectrum of communication, is like pure prose and pure mechanical communication. How do you make the decision on when you go to all cold, when you go to all hot, when you plug the drain and make the sink fill up and spill on the ground? Like, you know, when do you do the things you need to do? And I can pull from examples in my own work of when things have gone absolutely to one end or the other and when I make those decisions and stuff like that.
Yeah, let's hear one of those.
I put literally Discord usage instructions into this Discord Has Ghosts in It. There's an appendix that is all I actually just did technical writing for how to set up a Discord server.
Wow.
Because I know that no human being should know how to set up a Discord server.
No, it's not natural.
That's not natural. it's not right. And there is just, by Seb Pines, actually, my co-publisher here at Good Luck Press, writer, game designer, layout editor extraordinaire, wrote a story for this Discord Has Ghosts in It that then has some gameable stuff at the end. And the book is stronger for both of their inclusions. So just, it is a story called Activity Room, and it's kind of an MK Ultra style experiment that you then gain access to as the players, and you get to reinvestigate all of this stuff. And by reading the story, you're bringing some stuff into the game. And by reading the Discord usage instructions, you can figure out how to add permissions so that some people can speak sometimes and so that you get the channels in. But I mean, I want to hear both of your tastes. If a game can lean one way, lean another. I mean, obviously you want a cool mix of both, but I wonder if you both have examples of stuff that you like that you think threads this needle.
I mean, I feel like the game that I come back to as a game that's an example of the type of game book I like to read is 10 Candles. Because I feel like that so much, like every bit of writing and art and everything gets you back to the idea of tragic horror. Like all the mechanics, all the writing are all focusing on that one idea, and because that writing is so strong and because the mechanics are so strong towards that emotional goal that you're trying to hit, I think you are more likely to achieve what you're setting out to do in that game, have this tragic horror game, than you are with a lot with like the majority of tabletop role-playing games. But also I could go on the other end, and like Moonlight on Roseville Beach is just like a book I like to flip open and just like read through because it's cool.
Do you know some board game designers are deeply jealous of RPG designers because RPG players will just buy a book as a lifestyle item and then use it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I'm just reading this RPG because I like doing that because it's cool.
And yeah.
It's an absolutely essential tool for RPGs is that it is a book. People read books. You can write something worth reading and someone will enjoy reading.
I think I found that a lot with The Wild Sea recently. Just like reading through the lore and the vibes of that world. I've just been like, this is a great bedtime read.
Yeah.
I just like being here.
And has a lot of good technical writing like that. Like there is a lot of good mechanical direction in it. The book that I was going to call out as like, cause there's the books that I love that are like lean style, which I would say like is 10 Candles as well, is like reading Wander Home has that feeling of like you're living in the style of it. A book that I think threads the needle really well is Nova by Spencer Campbell. I'm thinking about that sentence you said of exquisitely gameable sentences, which I love as
Spencer's
a phrase.
So good at that.
And that is like Spencer's design characteristics to a T. Like Nova is this little book and like every page is like it's just oozing with game potential while being extremely clear about how to engage with it as a book and as a game.
I feel the same way about another Spencer's games, Hunt. That like the first off, like the art was just amazing. So the second I saw it, I was like, I'm gonna buy this, even if I never play it. But then you have to do so little work as like a game master or as a reader to understand how you will play it and also have such a great idea of the vibes of it. Yeah, Spencer slaps. He's great.
Yeah, I didn't edit Hunt. I work with Spencer so often that I'm just checking to see if I edited Nova. I believe I did. But
I think you did, yeah. But
I've got it right here. That's yep, editing by yep.
Great.
It's become a joke, Will, that like Elliot and I will be at, you know, we were at like PAX or something, and I'll pick up a book that I think looks interesting. I'll look through, I'll be like, oh, this is cool. And then I flip to the front and I go, guess who fucking edited this book? It is literally always you.
It's always you. Truly.
I just have cool friends. That's it. That's the only thing. I'm so lucky to work on all that stuff. I think going back to Spencer's work in particular, Spencer captures a mechanical exercise inside of sentences that is so cool. It's kind of blending everything together. They're as lean as they could be. And it's all the
without losing the style.
Yeah, absolutely. And that comes to a lot of Spencer's skill at affinity design. So as a reader and as a player, you can latch on to mechanical archetypes that you would like to express yourself in the game with. So for example, this one of the frames in Nova or whatever it is, like one of the class archetypes or, you know, things like this. You're like, oh, that's me. Like, I'm going to see this and I'm going to kind of bring this character archetype with me through the book, experiencing stuff, just building these iconic elements. All of Spencer's games conceptually include their iconics. So like the characters that define what the game is by their actions. So in Nova, it's the heroes of Nova. In Rune, it is all your Elden Ring fuckers, and you're bringing this character with you through the book as you are reading it, which is such a cool magic trick to do.
Totally.
That's why people put character creation up front. That's like the real reason. It's not because gamers ask for it. It's so you can have a proxy moving through the book with you.
Ooh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that little nugget. I'm going to hold on to that. So I feel like, you know, in terms of projects you've got coming up, Will, Big Grave, Fashion Fantasy, and Plasmodics, these seem like books that lean style at a they are not out yet glance, but I'm curious kind of where you think you're threading the needle with these two projects.
Yeah. So Plasmodics I can talk about a lot more because it is fully done. I have the layout file in front of me right now. And that game has a lot of jokes in it. I say this warily. It's a lot of jokes in that game. but a lot of the mechanics, and this is, for example, Plasmonics is a game where you play mutant freaks in the weird future. You are made of mutations and nuances. Mutations are things that have gone weird in your body and your mind. Nuances are things that have gone weird in your personality. So you are a mosaic pieced together Frankenstein of mutations and nuances that create a special butterfly that's going to move through the post-apocalypse in a spectacular way. And so there is just enough game in there to figure out how to use some of the mutations. By that, I mean there's like rules for activating them. You just say that you do it. And rules for using your nuances to overcome obstacles. But all of them have no mechanical reflection for you. So they're all interpretive. I would love to give you an example of this. So one of the mutations is thought sense. You can feel others' thoughts and intentions. Choose one. And they can feel yours, or you are compelled to be honest about these thoughts. Already making myself laugh with that one. But that's just a very particular type of mind control that you have to figure out how it actually works, like what that means for you. Another one is suggestion. You can plant an idea into another's mind. Choose one. They know it's you. Or two, you get one of their ideas, like a trade. And there's so much it's telling me a lot about what the character is by their choice, and the expression of this ability is really interesting. And some of that comes from in Gamma World, all the mutations are weird, and some of them have like unique mechanics that only work inside of that mutation. One example, when we are playing Gamma World in the Brain Trust Discord, which is for the Brain Trust podcast that Mina and Vasta, you can go check it out. We're we rebooted it. Anyway, back to the other plug. we were trying to get someone to light something on fire with their mind, and we had no fucking idea how it worked. Reading and rereading. I like to do games archaeology, which is when you get an old-ass game and play it exactly as it's written. And Gamma World was one of these that we did. And it was fantastic because we just didn't understand, like, the rules weren't very clear for how starting something, getting something on fire with your brain was. And so it just meant that we, like, in the game had a character looking at something for 20 minutes until it got hot enough to be on fire. Like, it was something like that. I was like, that's amazing. That's great. So funny.
Yeah.
And so taking, like in that intro that you read earlier, that is, you know, I'm not adapting that rule. I'm adapting the feeling of interpretation.
So your ability would be stare at something for 20 minutes till it catches on fire.
Yeah, I wonder if I have a pyrotechnical ability. I went through the Gamma World mutations and used the titles and then came up with my own effects for them. So some of them are from Gamma World, some... For example, I have a meta mutation, which are mutations that can change the world around you instead of in your mind or in your body or as a plant. So there's plant, physical, mental meta. My favorite mutation that really indicates what the game is doing in like an idea space, kind of this continuity of idea that I was talking about, is second location. This is a mutation. I don't have it in front of me, but I memorized it. When you find a location, you can find a second, much worse location.
That's good.
That rules.
And then people will just use it, like in a fight. Like, I'm just going to find somewhere worse than here. yeah. And combining kind of NSR sensibilities with games like Into the Odd and Cyber Metal 2012 and Gamma World, and finding what happens when you collide all those together. But that is to say, the rules are as pared down to the bone as you can, as with Gamma World, or as with, not Gamma World, Jesus Christ. Far too many matrices for that to be true. With Into the Odd by Chris McDowell, and Cyber Metal 2012 by Adam Vass, and finding out what happens when you leave them in a room together long enough.
Very cool.
So in addition to your games coming out, there's this project which you teased a little bit on our newsletter last year, and you've been working on the Yopst Style Guide. And I kind of want to dig in a little bit to the framework you introduced in that little teaser, which is these four perspectives, which this is the bit of your sort of strong perspective, or what I called expertise at the beginning, but we're not using that word anymore. We'll call strong perspective.
I'm an expert. I'm not a master.
Expert, not a master. This feels very characteristic of like what I see as like your perspective and your expertise. So what are kind of what's this four perspective framework that you're approaching the style guide with?
So the Yopst Style Guide is a project, an ongoing project to, through my work editing role-playing games, just talk about stuff that I think is interesting or helpful, would have been helpful to me 5 or 10 years ago. And I wanted to include lots of just technical aspects of writing RPGs, like how do you do the rule sentence? How do you manage capitalization through manuscript? How do you style a running example of play? How do you actually structure the rules? That kind of stuff. And then more interesting stuff like playtesting and game design and layout and all of this stuff. Because there are some foundational docs for me that if they were compiled like this would have been extremely helpful. Those things are like the RPG Design Podcast by Nathan D. Politta and Will Hindmarch is just one of the most powerful pieces of game education you can get, and you can get it for free. So there's one thing people should check out. It is the RPG Design Podcast. Is that what it's called? I have to double check.
We'll double check and pop in the show notes.
But I'm now making this connection between their work and mine. Nathan's work in general is very special and important to me. Nathan has a zine called the RPG Design Zine. Oh, it's called the Design Games Podcast. You can check out the link in the show notes. but the RPG Design Zine is a great resource that Nathan just copies elements out of his most foundational role-playing games to show. It's a cut-up zine that shows the design of games and the ethos of making games through the examples of games that Nathan literally just has around him. It's super cool, and you'll learn about some games that you might not have heard of or might have gotten a little, have faded a little bit in the year of our Lord 2024. But in this project, the Yopst Style Guide, I wanted to go for a cookbook style where you have a concept and you have a like definition of the concept, and then you have different methods for how to achieve the concept, because there's a billion ways to write a game. Far be it for me to say which one is the best one. I can probably write about three of those billion ways. And to talk about why each of those methods are interesting or important or useful, I use the four perspectives. It took me literally 5 minutes to get to the question. And those are, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a minute since I've looked at this. It's a project that I work on when I don't have open editing gigs. And guess what? I have had a lot of.
Open editing.
Hey, about to come on this podcast. I was talking to Elliot earlier today to be like, so what are we going to talk about? I think we want to talk a lot about editing and all of this other stuff. And I was in the middle of typing a message that was like, I don't think editing's as big as for me right now. And I just like just looked off into the distance, and I have three in progress projects right now. Like, maybe I can shut the fuck up about that.
Yeah, I can tell you for sure that editing's a big thing for you, seemingly all the time.
Yeah, I'm looking at my sagging bookshelves right now. To differ.
A lot of wasted ink on my name. Anyway, there is the player, the reader, the editor, and the layout artist. Did I have those right?
Nailed it.
The player is the person who needs stuff out of the rules right now. Like, they are using the book. It's use cases for the text on the book. So a player needs to extract something from the text like yesterday, and you need to give it to them. The reader is doing what Brian described earlier, opening up Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach and enjoying it, reading it, just luxuriating in the fact that this is a book and you can read it and it's super cool. Wild Sea you know, things like this. The editor is someone you are collaborating with on the manuscript to bring it to point B, whether that is putting their thoughts, their comments into it, whether it is getting it ready for layout, whatever. Whatever editing can be, whether it's a friend looking at it, an editor who does it full-time, you know. And a layout artist, as Brian was talking about earlier, also, how is a layout artist interacting with the text? What considerations do these methods afford them? So, for example, one of the things I have written is the how to style words and how to avoid overcapitalizing your game. And I call it the topographical sentence, is a lot of games will have a sentence that has lots of people and places in it that do things and save worlds. And you can hear all of the capitalization I'm putting into there with my voice and how that's not actually great. It's not actually a great way to read, but come up with solutions and how they impact those people down the line. So the reader, the player, the editor, and the layout artist. What can a layout artist do to alleviate a topographical sentence? You know, what can an editor do when they find a manuscript that has lots of this stuff? How does it affect a reader when they're destroying their eyes looking up and down that quickly? You know?
And it's not a hierarchical list. These are just the four things, four kind of, or these are a way of considering those four perspectives while you're making.
Yeah, I found it was a good way to remember how my writing is impacting people and the different uses people have for it. It's not like a novel where there's kind of just the way to use a novel.
And it's a thing we've talked about on the podcast a lot, of like how your collaborators are your first audience, you know, and if you give them that consideration and respect, you know, I won't drop like a total piece of crap into Brian's inbox. I mean, maybe I have before, but like I won't intentionally.
Not yet.
Well, I think that's okay, actually. I think that that's fine. That being comfortable sharing work and work, because over polish is a problem.
Sure.
You don't want to spend too long making something great before you know if it's good yet.
Totally.
That's a quotable.
We'll clip that.
It's more like, when you are moving something to the next step in the process. It's not really about brainstorming or design. It's like, here's a sentence level, you know. Another thing is I talk about, will be in the guide. I don't know when it's coming out. Like I said, if I have opening editing gigs, I just don't spend time on it because what am I? What am I, crazy? but it's the homunculus, which is a thing in a manuscript where there's a little guy who is also reading the manuscript with you and reacting to it and loving it. One version of this is the blue voice in Triangle Agency. Another is just a clippy in your book who's helping you out. So how to use those, when to use those, where they go. Some cool stuff.
It's very cool. I'm looking forward to reading more of it.
I just have to be out of work. So that's what it's going to take.
Quit hiring Will, guys. Quit it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to have a run of bad games so that Will's not, because as we've established, Will only works on good games. So I am curious, you know, when you're not designing, when you're not editing, other than writing the style guide, is there anything specific that you like to play or read or that you find is particularly inspirational to you?
In game land or at large?
I think both.
Okay, so I'm so glad that I can be on this podcast at this point to say this thing I have been thinking of. But first I'll say the machine's never off. That's not to say I don't ever stop working. I have such a strict schedule about when I work and when I don't work because it's not worth it to work all day. Just not worth it, especially when you're self-employed. Elliot?
Yes?
Can I suggest something to you?
Yeah.
4-day work week.
It'll be better than the 7-1 I've been doing for the last 2 years doing two jobs.
You've been doing 7 of the days.
Yes.
So maybe 3 for a couple years.
Yeah.
But that is to say, oh my God. I mean, we could just switch that to you're extremely burned out. Take a long break. Be extremely gentle with yourself when you're coming out of the job into what your life is going to look like. You are not going to do a good job at it for 6 months, just straight up. And giving yourself that time to be gentle and like some days will just be washes. That's okay. It's going to happen. You're not good at a new job until it's been 6 months. In 6 months, if you're not good, still fine. That's okay. Who cares? But yeah, just some advice for someone who does something similar. Yeah, 4 day work week. You'd go for it.
Appreciate it.
We had our best year ever, and we were doing 4 day work weeks. So it's definitely, definitely. You get more done and you do better work. Okay.
I'll talk to the boss. Boss is me.
I also have a really hard time like turning off completely on like off days where it'll be like a week and I'll be like, well, okay, I'm hanging out, but then also like, oh, I could do that. Hey, let me do that thing.
Yeah, Brian also pushed 6 or 7 days most of last year, I would say.
It's hard not to when you are, I mean, you're in TV and film, so already you're fucked. There's no winning. but also doing this and the AP, like, must be tough. Like, must be so difficult.
We moved to bi-weekly this year on the AP, so
that's so smart.
We're going for more sustainable this year.
And even then, we're looking at starting a new show. So
we don't need to tell them that, Brian.
I noticed that there's this hole in the schedule, and it makes me anxious instead of, like, it's a gift.
That's honestly...
Will,
that's
you can't attack us like that.
That's because so we had an idea for, like, a new show a while ago, and we're currently in the process of, like, waiting on what thing will come down the pipeline next. Like, who will say yes to what season next? And because for, like, 3 days, my destiny was out of my hands. I was like, "Fuck it, we can make another show. Let's do that. Let's make another show. Come on, let's do it."
Yeah,
and now
we have this joke on the team, Will, that Brian, there's this nuclear hot stone that Brian keeps reaching towards,
and we all have to
pull his hand back
because I know every it's hot, but he wants to touch it.
He thinks it can't be that hot.
Yeah. You just want to know how hot it, like, how hot is it? Like, how hot could it possibly be?
Where's my rock bottom?
Hot rock bottom.
Hot rock bottom. Like,
if you don't hit rock bottom, how will you ever know where it is? You know what I mean? I'm just groping around in the dark looking for my rock bottom. I got to find it.
I mean, you know, check the time code. We're talking about capitalism now. It's not your fault. The way the world is has made you apply rent-seeking behavior to your own brain, and now you're scamming yourself for pleasure. So it's just going to happen.
Yeah. I've gotten really efficient at it, too.
Yeah, no, you're good, because all your bosses were good, and the world is good at them. You know, and unlearning that stuff takes lots of effort and lots of energy, and it's not a linear path. Like, you will have good days and you'll have terrible days, but you can. I had this like goal a few years ago when I started full time for games, and it was this idea of like a 30 game backlog, a 30 game list, 30 title list, something like that, that I would find out what it takes for me to make, you know, these 30 games and what kind of life I want to live while pursuing that and what is important to me. And just pure production is not worth it. Games aren't good enough for me to have a horrible time making them. I could just go do something else. This dovetails into like, how do I relax? Doing anything but games, like anything. Whether that's playing music, reading, watching movies, going outside, cooking cool food, going to a museum. And the thing is, the more rested your mind is and the more productive like your rest time is. And I shouldn't even say those words. The more
productive
fruitful.
Rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more hustle your core is.
but there is something about like being very intentional about when you're off. Like, not just falling into being off, but being like, okay, no.
I'm not 80% off, 100% off, exactly. If you can pull it off.
You don't feel the effects of a vacation until it has been 7 days of vacation. Something a German man told me, okay?
And Germans famously know about vacations.
They just don't work in August.
I mean, yeah, most Europeans are better at vacation
than
we are.
They shut the fuck down. They get it.
Yeah. I remember I've had this happen multiple times, but like I've had a ton of conversations recently about like we're ordering something. When will it be in? And a bunch of people will look down at their watches or look down at their calendars and be like, well, Lunar New Year's right now. So everything's backed up for like 4 weeks. I was like, man, we got to do that. We got to start picking just a whole month where we don't do anything as a society.
Yeah. Lunar New Year is sick, societally speaking. It also means RPG people chill the fuck out also because a lot of printing happens in China. So a lot of people are just sitting on their hands. But yeah, what can I say other than every time I have a conversation like this, it turns into a conversation about burnout and what to do about it. It is not solid science that burnout is recoverable, right? That like this idea of being burned out, if you're burned out now, it might actually be too late to go back to before. But you can find ways to to continue living on, treating your body okay, treating your mind okay, making sure you're not scamming yourself every live long day with your hobbies and side hustles and monetizing them. I'm talking to two RPG podcasters from one to another. I can tell you that, yeah, it's, you know, take the bi-weekly day. Just stop doing episodes sometimes if you need to. Like, it's good for you. Life is so long, and it will be a lot longer and greater if you don't burn yourself out all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep trying to remind myself that.
I think we're getting better. We're moving to bi-weekly. I quit my day job so that I'm not, you know, working double duty. But we'll see how we do.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear how it goes. It's, like I said, it's not linear. Some days are going to be great, some days are not. But if you keep, like, I can really recommend, like, go check out a lot of the GDC, the Game Developer Conference YouTube channel has tons of talks on burnout and team burnout and not pulling heroics and all that kind of stuff. And I think just as an organization, it's a good thing to be aware of. And it's just great. I mean, I was on a panel at Breakout Con and I was next to an RPG luminary, a true blue RPG luminary, but had alluded to multiple family members who are in the biz getting coronaries from the work that they were doing and how they were doing it. And that this person had had long and fruitful career in RPGs and was still working 7 day weeks and all of this stuff. And it's like, for what? I simply am too aware of it to want to do that. It's not worth it to me. So just to pull it all the way back, 30 game backlist, how do I get there? What kind of life do I want to live? How do I want to have a relationship with work and games that's fruitful and I get to do my best work? What kind of stuff do I like to do? Drink coffee, listen to freaking jazz, dude. That shit's great.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a day today where I just like couldn't get anything done. I just couldn't do it. And so midway through the day, I said, fuck it. And I went out and I bought Brussels sprouts and I made 2 Brussels sprouts recipes back to back. And I just had a pound of Brussels sprouts.
I'm punching the air. What did you make?
Just like 2 different methods of like adding, basically like 2 different sauces.
No, Brian, we want details.
Oh, one of them was just in olive oil and then like in a cast iron and then finished in the oven with shallots, garlic, and a little bit of balsamic, which were great. And I've done that recipe before. And then I did one afterwards that had a maple and sherry vinegar reduction.
Wow.
That was good, but I didn't do it well. So I don't really know if it, how good it was, but I think it will be good after I try it again.
That rocks.
It's very good.
Double Brussels braai.
It was wild. I made half of it and I had, I don't know, a half a pound of Brussels sprouts basically for lunch. And I was like, you know what? I want to do that again. Let's run it back. And so I ran it back.
You know what? My piss is going to be crazy today.
I told Abby, like, don't come home. I'm going to have the weirdest farts. It's going to be wild.
Yeah, it's going to get weird. So Will, our closing question that we always ask, and you've already given, you know, a number of very good life recommendations and collaboration recommendations, but this one is nice and direct. It's what are you bringing to the table? This could be a person, a game, a show, a resource, a book, anything in tabletop, anything not in tabletop that you want to just recommend to the listeners to check out.
Yeah, you sent me this question earlier, and I just thought about it all day, and it was tough to come up with something. I'm going to be honest. It was weird. I was like, oh, yeah, I'll just come up with something something good. So I would say the thing I'm going to bring is having a hobby that has nothing to do with tabletop games. Something that you can learn about, that you can practice, that you can get good at for no other reason other than your own enjoyment and desire to do such a thing.
Any hobby you'd recommend?
Music's cool.
Or anything you've been enjoying lately?
Art is cool. Do something that you're like, think of the thing you're all thinking of it now. What would it be cool to know how to do? Speaking Spanish. Okay. Something like that. Drawing a pretty picture. Painting. Cooking. Brussels sprouts two ways. Gonna make the apartment go wild tonight, smell wise.
Hobby is making the apartment go wild, smell wise.
Let me tell you, neighbors. I can accomplish that. No masters in TTRPGs. There are masters in this apartment.
Yeah,
yeah,
masters
in making the apartment smell wild
in a medieval sense. There are, but yeah, I think. Hobbies that you're aesthetically drawn to are the best ones because you liked it before you started doing it, and for you can see what you liked in it, and you can hold on to that while you are going through the awkward growing phases that happen literally every 4 months when you're doing the hobby. So yeah,
it's a great rec and one that we don't have to link in the show notes. So go find a new hobby.
You know, links in the show notes.
Go to hobbylobby.com and find.
Go to hobbylobby.com. That's exactly.
Persian artifacts from Persian and Iraqi artifacts.
Talk of the Table, sponsored by hobbylobby.com.
No, I can't appear on this podcast.
No. For legal reasons, that is a joke. And for actual reasons, it is a joke. Thank you so much, Will, for coming to the table today. Do you want to let people know where on the internet they can find you?
I've been Willie Obst. Thank you so much for having me on this super cool podcast. You can go to goodluckpress.co and find all my games and everything cool that you can buy with money. You can find me on Twitter at @will_jobst, but otherwise, that's me.
And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter, where you can read some of the Will Yobst style guide. And you should check out the many-sided media Discord, where you can talk about this show and My First Dungeon. Those are both linked in the show notes, because we put everything in the show notes here. Rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.